minutes to 4 o'clock, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We'll join National Public Radio at 5 o'clock for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. This evening, one of the most divisive issues of the tax overhaul debate, the IRA, Individual Retirement Account. We'll hear how it works, who it serves, and how it affects the economy. Also, an expert on medical ethics talks about issues raised by the baby Jesse heart transplant case. That's beginning at 5 o'clock on All Things Considered, and will be followed at 6:29 by 91 Report, our regional news magazine. Well, with me now on Fresh Air is lawyer Alan Dershowitz, who's very controversial because of some of the unpopular causes and clients he's taken on. He defended the First Amendment rights of Nazis to Martin Skokie. His clients have ranged from murderer and writer Jack Henry Abbott to porn star Harry Reams and Soviet dissident Anatoly Sharansky. He admits that some of his clients have in fact been guilty and says that any defense lawyer who says otherwise is either bluffing or deliberately limiting his practice to a few innocent defendants. He says he selects his clients without considering their guilt or what he thinks of them personally. He tries to pick the most challenging and precedent-setting cases. He describes himself as primarily a lawyer of last resort, a lawyer to turn to after the jury has handed out a guilty verdict. And that describes the circumstances when Klaus von Bülow asked Dershowitz to represent him for his appeal. Von Bülow had been found guilty in 1982 of murdering his heiress wife by injecting her with an overdose of insulin. He was sentenced to 30 years in prison but was released on $1 million bail pending appeal. Dershowitz headed von Bülow's appeal and won. In the appeal, Dershowitz presented evidence that the insulin-encrusted needle that von Bülow allegedly used as the murder weapon was, in fact, never used to inject insulin. After the appeal was won, the state retried von Bülow, and he was acquitted. The von Bülow case is the subject of Dershowitz's new book, Reversal of Fortune. Alan Dershowitz is also in the news now as an outspoken critic of the Mies Commission on Pornography, a subject we'll discuss a little bit later. His new book, Reversal of Fortune, has just been published by Random House. Welcome back to Fresh Air.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
You weren't involved with von Bülow's first trial before the appeal. Were you following it on TV or in the papers? Did you care?
No. You know, he's not my kind of guy. He's not the kind of person whose case I'd be interested in. My attitude toward the case was, you know, these rich and idle people are playing games with each other, and they got about what they deserved. And I had really no interest. In fact, when he first called me, the only thing I knew about him is that he was Danish. And he called me on April Fool's Day and with a very thick British accent early in the morning. And I thought it was some imposter, some family friend playing a joke because I knew he was Danish and not English. But he had been educated in England. Sure enough, it was him. And he asked me to take on the case.
What did you want to know from him when he asked you to take the case before agreeing or refusing?
Well, my first instinct was to say, hey, you know, you wouldn't invite me to dinner in Newport. Your people there don't accept people like me in your homes. Why don't you get somebody who you would invite to dinner to represent you? So my first instinct was I didn't like him. I didn't like what he stood for. But then we started to talk, and he told me the story about how the wealth on the other side of the family, the incredible wealth that Mrs. von Bülow's family had, was really used to circumvent the Constitution, to allow private prosecutors to conduct searches that were illegal, to take interviews and then not produce the notes. And it occurred to me that there was a very important issue involved here about whether private parties can really do an end run around the Constitution. And that's when I decided to take the case on the assumption that he was probably guilty.
But you thought that there'd be a First Amendment precedent here, and that's what interested you.
Legal issues that I thought were really going to be very important. He kept, of course, saying he was not guilty, but I'm used to that. All my clients in the beginning tell me they're not guilty, and most of them are lying.
So you took it on and you wanted to investigate this idea of whether if they hired a private party to go through his belongings, whether that violated his First Amendment rights or not.
Yeah.
Did you think he was guilty or innocent? You thought he was
guilty? I thought he was probably guilty. I mean, you know, first of all, he looked guilty. He seemed guilty. The evidence against him at his first trial was overwhelming. You know, Klaus von Bülow himself recently said if he had been on the jury at the first trial, he would have voted to convict. So surely I had the right to assume that the evidence against him was convincing.
What about his behavior? Do you find that guilty defendants behave differently than people who are actually innocent?
I think they do. Now, you know, none of us is an expert in determining guilt from innocence. And I don't mean the sweaty palms or the nervousness. That has nothing to do with whether a person's guilty or innocent. It's how they tell you to handle the case. Mostly guilty people want to keep evidence out. And mostly innocent people want to let it all in. And he said to me right from the beginning, go get an investigative reporter,
hire the world's leading forensic experts, get all the doctors. And I kept saying to him, Klaus, no. A good investigative reporter will find out the truth. And doctors can't be bought, good scientific experts. If they find out you injected her with insulin, they will give it to you. You'll have no chance of winning. And he kept saying, do it anyway. We want to get to the bottom of this mystery. And that did lead me to think that he was probably innocent.
When you took on the case, I think it became, it was written about in the press. And I think some people speculated that once you were taking on the case, that you were going to try to find some technicality or loophole that you could get him off on, and that it wouldn't mean that he wasn't in fact guilty of the murder, but you'd find some loophole in the law that you can get him off on.
Well, that was the position taken by the von Arsberg family and their henchman, William Wright, who wrote the earlier book on the von Bülow case. He wrote in his book that I never look to try to find people innocent. I just try to find legal technicalities. And by hiring me, Wright said, Klaus von Bülow was in effect admitting his guilt. Well, we now know that William Wright's book was in effect vetted in advance by the von Arsberg family. They had written a contract with him that in exchange for exclusive interviews, they would have the right to read the book and make suggestions for changes. So I don't think his book had much credibility.
So you did get him off on the grounds that you initially intended to, that his mm-hmm. rights were violated and that search was illegal even though it was a private search. Mm-hmm. How would you have felt him if he actually was the murderer but you got him off on the invasion of privacy?
I would have felt terrible. I would have had mixed feelings. Terrible in the sense that I had allowed a guilty person to escape justice. On the other hand, I would have felt that I had vindicated a constitutional principle. That's not hypothetical. That has happened in my life. In my first book, The Best Defense, I opened with a story about a bunch of kids that I knew from Brooklyn when I was growing up who had been the Jewish Defense League bombers and had planted a bomb in Saul Urach's office and tragically killing an innocent woman. I got them off on purely constitutional grounds. There was no question of their guilt or innocence. They were as guilty as could be. They asked me to come to a victory celebration afterward. I wouldn't go. I had nothing to celebrate. I felt, I guess, a little bit like a surgeon who goes into an operating room and is told that the man who he's performing the heart bypass surgery on is the head of the mafia. And if he would just let the scalpel slip a little bit, he could help society a lot. But if he performs a brilliant operation, the guy's going to go out and commit more crimes. Would any self-respecting surgeon do anything but perform the best possible surgery? That's certainly the way an American lawyer has to feel about representing guilty defendants in front of our system. You know, about an hour ago, I spoke to Anatoly Sharansky, who I represented for 9 years. What a pleasure it was to be able to pick up the phone and directly dial him in Israel. What I wouldn't have done to be able to do that in the Soviet Union for 8 years. And, of course, one of the reasons I represented him is that no Soviet lawyer was prepared to represent a man who the Communist Party in the Soviet Union declared to be guilty. We don't want that kind of system in this country. That's why we represent the guilty, to protect the innocent.
So in a lot of ways, you feel like your client is really the law more so than the individual?
My client is the Bill of Rights. Obviously, the means for achieving the Bill of Rights is the client. But once I take the case, I have to think only about my client.
Let's get back to Klaus von Bülow. My guest is lawyer Alan Dershowitz. What kind of defense team did you build? What kind of legal team did you build to help you in researching the case? You had really a large team that you mobilized.
The big difference between the way the first trial was conducted and the rest of the case is the first trial was defended by the Lone Ranger and Tonto. Basically, two lawyers who come to town all alone. They had virtually no staff, no research assistants, and they tried to win the case the way so many lawyers try to win the case, by oratory in the courtroom, flashy stands in the courtroom, by knowing the right people, by being able to talk the right way to the jury. You don't win cases that way. You win cases by investigation on the field. Cases are not run in the courtroom. They are won in the field. And I hired 18 students and a bunch of other lawyers to work with me. We left no stone unturned. We had a student go to a gay bathhouse to interview a drug dealer. We had students hanging around the port in Newport, Rhode Island to pick up information. We had students going to the medical schools, interviewing Nobel Prize-winning doctors and correcting them. They knew so much, our students, about insulin injections that they really had become instant experts. That's the way we won the case, not in the courtroom. I don't think there is a lawyer in the country that could have won the first case on the basis of the evidence that was presented, and I don't think there's a decent lawyer who could have lost the second case.
Well, you challenged the evidence, basically. Let's talk about the first case. Can you describe What was admitted into the court as the murder weapon in the first case?
Well, one minor correction in your otherwise excellent description is that Sonny Von Bulow is still alive, tragically in a coma. She will never recover.
You know, I didn't realize she was still alive.
Still alive. And the charges, therefore, are technically assault with intent to murder, attempted murder, in effect. So there was no murder weapon. It was an attempted murder weapon. But the attempted murder weapon was a needle found in Klaus Von Bulow's black bag, which was coated, they said, with insulin. At the first trial, the Lone Ranger and Tonto basically stipulated that the needle contained insulin because one scientific test had showed that it did contain insulin. When we came into the test case, we did completely new tests, and we discovered, lo and behold, that the insulin readings were false positives, that there was no insulin on the needle. Our forensic experts told us, moreover, that the needle was probably never injected into a human being, that it was most likely dipped into solution to appear to have been injected. We discovered that the insulin level in her blood, which the jury at the first trial heard was very high, was also a false reading. There had been three readings. Only one of them was high. The other two were low, and no doctor will accept one out of three readings as accurate. Most importantly, we discovered that the maid's testimony at the first trial, that she had seen syringes and insulin in Klaus von Bulow's black bag, was almost certainly a fabrication. What happened is, 8 days after the second coma, she was interviewed, this maid, Maria Schralheimer, by the private lawyer. But the private lawyer suppressed the notes with the help of the court, never produced the notes because the court said they were privileged. What did the note show? She was asked what was in the black bag, and she listed everything she found in the black bag. But she did not mention insulin. She did not mention syringes. She did not mention needles. Her memory, like Alice in Wonderland's, got better with time until she remembered things before they even happened.
So if the attempted murder weapon isn't, in fact, an attempted murder weapon, and if the evidence questioned by offered by the maid is challenged, then there isn't much of a case
left. There wasn't much left. Remember, at the first trial, they found the smoking gun. That is, they found the insulin needle. They found the bullet wound, the high level of insulin in her body. They found the fingerprints, essentially. They had an airtight case. By the time it came for the second trial, their airtight case had blown up in their face. And the second lawyer at the second trial really had a rather easy job in demolishing their medical testimony.
What are the rules of an appeal? Can you start the case as if from scratch and to say this man is innocent? Or can you just talk about the procedures of the first trial and challenge those procedures?
Technically, you can only talk about what went on at the first trial. But what are judges? They are human beings in black robes. They are real people. They want to know what the truth is. They want to know whether we're dealing with an innocent or a guilty defendant. So what I did, and I think my major contribution to this case, was to present the Court of Appeals with arguments of an innocent person, not of a guilty person. We didn't ask for suppression of evidence. We asked for inclusion of evidence. We didn't argue about an exclusionary rule. We argued for an inclusionary rule. And I think the message was received by the court that we were really challenging the guilt of Klaus von Bulow. And when you challenge the guilt and provide evidence in support of that, courts are willing to listen. They're not sympathetic to technical arguments, even about constitutional rights, but they are sympathetic when they have doubts about whether the defendant was guilty.
Can you just bring up this new evidence?
It was very hard. We submitted affidavits, and some of them were struck by the court, and some of them were included. We also had new information. We had dramatic new information from Truman Capote, who had known Sonny Von Bulow for a long time.
That was one of the first big breaks for
him,
wasn't it?
Yeah, and he came forward totally on his own and told us that he and she had injected themselves together. They had taught each other how to do it. That he
recreational drugs?
Yeah, and he had actually seen her just a few weeks before her first coma with a little black bag, with syringes, and with needles, and with injectable material.
And that was important information because it was believed before that Klaus von Bulow was the only person in the whole house who knew how to inject.
That's right. And there's no question he did because he was injecting himself and her with vitamin B12 and Majorca back in the late 1960s. But now we had dramatic new evidence that there were injections all over the place in that household and that she was a woman who was also a self-abuser, certainly of pills and of barbiturates, of aspirin, of Inderol, of sugar because she had reactive hypoglycemia. She was not a woman who treated her body like a temple.
You had this incredible team researching for you, but how could you, after all the time had elapsed, go back to the insulin-encrusted needle, as it was described, and do tests on it to Would the test be accurate after that long? And after all the tests had all, I assume tests had been run initially.
They had been. Not only that, but the insulin, alleged insulin material, the washings on the needle had been destroyed, tragically. If this had been sent to a forensic lab, a good government forensic lab, they wouldn't have been. But because the private prosecutor did all these tests, there was nothing left for us to retest. So what we had to do was reconstruct the situation. We got photographs. We got descriptions of what was tested. Then we did our own experiment. For example, we took a needle and we said to the lab, tell us what's on it. And we sent the needle in and it had no insulin. It only had saline solution, amobarbital, and Valium. And it tested positive for insulin. And in that we were able to demonstrate, we were tipped off by a British scientist, that amobarbital, saline, and Valium do test false positively for insulin. And we were able to cast doubt on the test. We were not able to prove beyond any reasonable doubt that the needle did not contain insulin, only that the conclusion that it did was subject to grave doubt. We were able to cast doubt on every part of the state's case.
Do you think that the defense should have done a better job for his first trial?
Frankly, I think the defense should have done a better job at the first trial and the second trial. I was not thrilled at the defense case as it was presented even at the second trial. I think too much reliance was placed on in-court testimony and in-court examinations. I think lawyers got to get out in the field. And I'm going to continue to use this case, by the way, to teach my students at Harvard Law School the importance of investigation, which we don't teach enough about at law school. But I don't think the defense at the first trial did an excellent job. But as I say, nor do I think the defense at the second trial did an excellent job. But they won, so how do you criticize them?
Von Bülow did not testify in his first trial. Mm-hmm. What was your attitude about whether he should or shouldn't testify in the appeal?
Well, first of all, he came to me and he said, I must testify. I have to testify. I must be vindicated. And he went public. He went on Barbara Walters and other shows and said, I'm going to testify at the second trial if I get a second trial. But he didn't testify in the end at the second trial. And that was strongly over his own objection. He wanted to testify because he wanted to be vindicated. I kept saying to him, Klaus, a criminal trial can't vindicate you. Only history can vindicate you. A criminal trial can only determine whether you go to jail or you don't. Let's win this case and then you can vindicate yourself. We didn't want him to take the stand because the second trial was purely a medical trial. Did he or did he not inject his wife with insulin? And what would he have to say about that, except I didn't do it? He's not a medical expert. By having him testify, we would have diverted the attention away from the medical doctors and onto, is Klaus von Bülow a nice man? Did he treat his wife okay? What about his affairs with other women? What about the fact that he didn't work during his marriage? What about the fact that he lived in Newport as a snob? What about the fact that he has an aristocratic bearing and isn't very likable as a person? We didn't want to put that on trial. Under American law, you don't put the individual on trial. You put the crime on trial. And there was no crime, so Klaus von Bülow didn't have to take the witness stand.
Do you think that juries are ultimately prone to deciding on whether they like the person or not? You know,
I think so.
The personality?
Once a defendant takes the witness stand, everything else is relegated to an opening act. And basically, the defendant goes on trial. The most important question the jury asks is, did he lie? And it's awfully hard to put a defendant on the witness stand for day after day after day without catching him in some fib or some omission or some contradiction. So putting a witness on the stand is a very calculated risk. Often, you have to do it. You have no choice. But sometimes, you can put the crime on trial, and that's essentially what we did in the von Bülow case.
It was such a highly covered case. There was TV coverage. Mm-hmm. There were actually cameras in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. There was press coverage. And because this was a real Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous type case, it had all these soap opera type storylines in it. Was it hard to keep that out of the case? You're saying that you wanted to present this as a medical case. But really what so many people wanted to know was the kinds of things you were trying to keep out, like who was he sleeping with? Did he really hate his wife? Did he want her money?
That's right. And that's why one of the most idiotic decisions made by this lawyer in the second trial, Tom Puccio, was to try not to have the jury sequestered. He argued to let the jury hear all this stuff. I screamed and yelled at him, no, we need a sequestered jury. We need a jury that doesn't hear all this testimony if you want to have a pure medical case. Fortunately, the judge ruled against him, and I think he won the case against his own motions. If he had had his way and that motion would have passed, would have succeeded, and the case would have been tried to a jury which had access to the press, I think he would have lost. You know, this was the most highly publicized trial in the history of the world, in the sense that no case has ever had more television coverage than the von Bülow case. No case ever. There were over 200 media people. Every move was covered in the press. It was the one of the first major trials ever covered live. Every move in the case was reproduced. There were sideshows going on. There was this character named David Marriott and the priest and the Truman Capote information. And to have allowed this jury to sit in the box and to have assumed that they wouldn't read the newspapers and see the television coverage was just plain silly.
My guest is lawyer Alan Dershowitz, and he's written a new book called Reversal of Fortune, which is about the Klaus von Bülow case. And Dershowitz headed up the legal team that won von Bülow's appeal. Let's get to the idea of television. Now, this was in Rhode Island, carried live, and it was seen live in some other places as well on television.
It was seen live nationally over the CNN network. They covered it every day, practically gavel to gavel.
How aware are lawyers and witnesses that they're live on television, and how much do you think that that affects the performance of of the legal teams and of the witnesses?
It has some impact, but I think it's generally a positive impact. It makes the judges behave better. Because if you ever go into a courtroom anywhere and see how judges behave on a typical day, you're not going to be thrilled with the American system of justice. Television cameras, I think, upgrades the quality of justice. I think in the beginning, witnesses...
What are you implying? The judges are not
lazy,
paying attention?
Lazy. They don't pay attention. They routinize matters. Not all. There are some great judges. But there are too many judges who just think they're doing a day's work and don't start every case with a presumption of innocence. I think television helps upgrade the quality of justice. I think it also shows the ineptness of many lawyers in this country and the fact that too many lawyers spend too much time showing off their verbal skills and not enough time preparing. Basically, we live in a democracy. There's no reason why the court shouldn't be as exposed to public scrutiny as other institutions of government. We now have cameras in the Senate. We have cameras in the House. Occasionally, our president even deigns to give a press conference. But the judiciary, the United States Supreme Court, you know, just the other day we had a major decision on abortion or in baby Doe cases. Why shouldn't the American public have a right to hear those arguments? Why shouldn't the American public have a right to see those decisions being rendered? The Supreme Court justices have something to be afraid of? I have to tell you, I think they do. I think if Warren Burger's handling of arguments in the United States Supreme Court were subject to television coverage, the American public would have a very different view of our Chief Justice than they do by his very pleasant appearance in photographic opportunities.
How would it be different?
Well, I think he's not a very bright man. I think he's not a very great justice. He's not very learned in the law. And if I were Chief Justice Warren Burger, I also wouldn't want television in the courtroom. But that's not a good reason for keeping it out.
What did you think of the press interpretations of the case?
The press is always very cynical. In the first trial, I think they all thought he was guilty but would get acquitted. At the second trial, I think there was a great mix of conclusions as to whether he was guilty or not guilty. On balance, I think the press coverage was pretty good, but they were not very good at predicting the outcome because, like a non-sequestered jury, they heard everything. And when you hear everything, you begin to say to yourself, the kind of man who would pose in leather in Vanity Fair magazine, something that the press all heard about but the jury didn't hear about, is that the kind of man we think is guilty or innocent? The press is more like the general public and less like the jurors, so they're not very good at predicting the outcome of cases. I make a suggestion in the book. The press might be well advised to hire in a publicized case like this 3 or 4 people to sit as jurors, to hear only the evidence the jury hears, and then for them to be interviewed at night and see how the case is really going for the jurors, not for the people out there in the general public.
My guest is lawyer Alan Dershowitz. You were criticizing the defense in the appeal, and you actually headed up the team that won the appeal, but you weren't the lawyer, the main lawyer arguing.
On the appeal. No, I was the main lawyer. I argued the appeal myself.
So who are you criticizing?
I criticize everybody. That's my nature. I'm a critic. You know, I'll probably criticize you even though you do a brilliant job on this show. I criticize myself. I'm a teacher, teacher's critic. And I always look at – basically my job as a teacher is to do autopsies on trials that fail. I always look at the cases. And I'm going to have this case as one of my class teaching materials. So I was critical of the trial lawyer who tried the first case. I am critical of the trial lawyer who tried the second case. And I'm critical of the way we handled the appeal. We won – But as I say in the book, winning doesn't mean you did the right thing. I have seen lawyers do terrible jobs and win and do brilliant jobs and lose.
You have compared putting together a defense with producing a TV show. Mm-hmm. How are they similar?
Well, you have an enormous amount of unedited material when you do a case, and you have to decide basically on how to edit it to present it to the jury or the appellate court. You have to be honest and realistic and present a completely candid and full portrayal, but you don't have all the time in the world. You can't catch the attention of the jury for more than really a fleeting few moments. And so this book, in a sense, is modeled on the film Rashomon, where, you know, the murder rape is shown five different times and the audience is entitled to draw its own conclusions. Or in a sense, like a segment of 60 Minutes or some other magazine show where you have thousands and thousands of feet of film and you decide how to edit it down to accurately present it, but in brief sense.
Did you get to know Klaus von Bülow well?
Yes.
During the trial? And did your opinions of him personally change?
Oh, inevitably they do. I tried my best not to like him because I don't like what he stands for. I don't like some of his background. He's not my type of guy. But you get to know him so well. I still know him very well. I speak to him virtually every day. We have dinner every time I come to New York because he has ongoing problems, ongoing litigation really on behalf of his daughter. There are two Klaus von Bülows. He walks into a room. He seems to unconsciously decide which switch to throw on. There's the austere Danish aristocrat. And there's the kind of warm, loving father who's something of a clown, likes puns, likes jokes, cares for people who are on his side. And it's when you walk in the morning and it's hard to know which Klaus von Bülow is going to emerge. One of the reasons he didn't take the witness stand is we were afraid he'd throw the wrong switch. And he'd present himself to the jury in this austere way, which is not designed to win friends and influence jurors.
Although you say you don't take on a client because you like them or because you don't like them, the personality shouldn't enter into it. Does it help you if you can find a way to like the person who you're representing?
Probably in a psychological sense it does. I'm more likely to represent somebody who I don't like in the sense that the less likable the person is, the less likely he's to be able to get a good lawyer to represent him. And I come in where other lawyers won't. And that's why I was willing to talk to a Jack Henry Abbott who doesn't have very many friends. Or, when the Oberfuhrer from the Nazi Party in Boston called to ask me to represent him on a free speech issue. The more despicable the person, the more likely I am willing to represent him. Klaus von Bülow turned out to be a relatively decent person in the end. Nobody's perfect. But it didn't really affect my decision to represent him.
By the time the jury went to deliberate, were you and he pretty sure you'd won the appeal?
Well, it's interesting. We were pretty sure we'd won the second trial once the jury went to deliberate, although he asked me if I was ready to make a bail motion. But the appeal was even more interesting. When I argued the appeal, that is after he had been convicted, I've been arguing appeals and practicing law and involved in appeals for 22 years. Never in my life have I ever heard of a leak when a case was argued. We argued the case on a Monday. By Wednesday, we had been told we had won. The information had leaked. We were told who was writing the opinion. We were told what the opinion would say. Lawyers claimed to have seen advance copies of the opinion. One of the judges told a journalist how the opinion would come out and sought his advice as to how the media would handle it. By the way, she's now a candidate for Chief Justice of Rhode Island and denying that story. She will regret denying that story because the evidence will be forthcoming as to precisely who it was she told. But this was remarkable, how we learned well in advance how the case was coming down. Rhode Island justice, which some people have called an oxymoron, really was a shock and a surprise to me. I just never seen justice practice anywhere else the way I'd seen it in Rhode Island.
Well, the way you describe it, von Bülow, when he hired you to head up his appeal, was a little afraid about how to handle his first two lawyers.
That's right.
Because they were both Rhode Island lawyers.
No, one was a Rhode Island lawyer. The other was a New York lawyer who had been brought in by the Rhode Island lawyer.
And he'd been advised to make sure that he had a good Rhode Island lawyer,
right,
so that he'd be in with the in crowd, so to speak.
Right. Well, the recommendation came from the United States Senator from Rhode Island, Claiborne Pell, to hire John Sheehan, the local fella who knew all the judges and made great claims as to his access to judges and great claims as to what he had accomplished behind closed doors. And Klaus was frankly afraid to fire him. because he was afraid that if you lose the local connection in a state like Rhode Island, you can be in very big trouble.
Well, do you think that those perceptions were accurate? Do you think there is this old boys network of justice there?
I don't think those perceptions can continue for long unless they're confirmed in some way by reality. The judge in this case, all the judges in this case really went out of their way to confirm these perceptions, even to the last humorous comment by Judge Grandy as we were all leaving the courtroom, saying, "You're always welcome back here out of town counsel as long as you bring Jack Sheehan with you." I mean, that kind of message may be meant in humor, but it certainly confirms all the worst aspects of a legal system that needs deep, thorough investigation.
Were you afraid it would work against you, being not only an out-of-town lawyer, but a high-profile out-of-town lawyer?
Sure, and I told Klaus that. And there is reasonable cause for concern in a place like Rhode Island, which is insular and small, has a rule against out-of-state lawyers practicing except with special permission. There was also a concern that if I started blowing the whistle, which I was tempted to do on many occasions because I'm a professor and I think I have a high standard of ethics about these things, that it would hurt the client. So what I decided to do is win the case first and then blow the whistle. And I've blown the whistle. And what do you think the response of Rhode Island has been? They refuse to investigate. They're threatening me with discipline for the crime of, what is it, revealing a state secret? That there is some appearance of corruption in Rhode Island. Well, of course, the Rhode Island Constitution and the United States Constitution fully protect me as a citizen, as a lawyer, to speak the truth, and that's what I'm going to continue doing.
Yeah, the Rhode Island Bar said that they would seek disciplinary action. What would that mean?
First they said they would seek disciplinary action after they'd read the book. They made this threat before they had read the book. The Supreme Court of Rhode Island was asked to investigate the charges of a leak. Without any investigation, without any opportunity on my part to present the evidence, they unanimously declared themselves innocent and recommended again that I be disciplined. I don't know what that means. I welcome an inquiry, disciplinary or otherwise, if it gives me subpoena power. If I have the power to call witnesses, boy, they're going to be in for some rude shocks and surprises about the quality of justice in Rhode Island. This, again, Alice in Wonderland notion of verdict first, trial thereafter. We're going to declare ourselves innocent and Dershowitz guilty without an opportunity to present the evidence. It may work in Rhode Island. It's not going to work anywhere else.
Do you enjoy these kinds of challenges?
Well, I don't like personal style confrontations. I'm a lawyer. I like representing other people. But I knew that when I said what I honestly believe to be the case about Rhode Island, that they would not sit back quietly and accept it. I've said the same things, by the way, about federal courts. I've said the same thing about Chief Justice Warren Burger. I've said the same thing about the Massachusetts system, but only as Rhode Island reacted in such a knee-jerk, insular, defensive way.
My guest is lawyer Alan Dershowitz, and his new book, Reversal of Fortune, is about his it's about the Klaus von Bülow case, and he ran the appeal. After you won the appeal for Klaus von Bülow, then the state tried him again. How does that work, by the way? How does it work after a trial and an appeal? If the appeal's won, what do you need to bring that back and try the person again?
In the United States, as distinguished from England, you can always bring back a trial for a second go-around, provided that there's enough evidence and provided that the appeal was won on legal grounds rather than factual grounds. But most times, at least, there's an opportunity to sit down with the prosecutor, to tell him or her the case, and to try to argue with them not to bring the second trial. I sought an opportunity to meet with the high-profile Attorney General of Rhode Island, Arlene Violet, former nun, who's now the Attorney General. She refused to sit down and talk to me, and it really hurt her because we would have laid out our whole case, and she probably would have either decided not to prosecute, or at least she would have had a leg up knowing what our case was. But for some reason, she refused to sit down and talk to us. Now, this former nun has gone ahead and indicted a priest, one of the witnesses that appeared for us in the case, who came and corroborated the testimony of this man named David Marriott. Instead of prosecuting David Marriott, the young drug dealer, she gave him immunity and went after a priest. She'll have to respond to why she did that, but it provides yet another interesting wrinkle on this never-ending case.
What's the status now of Klaus von Bülow? He was acquitted in that second trial.
He's a free man. He can never be tried again for any crime. But the stepchildren have brought a $56 million civil suit against him. I'm now trying to bring him yet to a third trial, triple jeopardy, for basically the same set of acts.
what do you do? You're on a press tour now. What do you do when people really want to ask you? So, okay, so you won the case, but who is he sleeping with? And, you know, what was his relationship with his wife? Do you talk about things like that?
I don't know most of that. I mean, I know what I needed to know to win the case. And I didn't want to write a book that was just a collection of gossipy tidbits. There are obviously some gossipy items in there because they became very relevant to win the case. His relationship to his mistress, Alexandra Iles, was central to his winning the case. His, in fact, sexual relationship with his wife was essential. All of that played a role, and therefore I reveal it, but I don't reveal any extra gossip. For that, you're going to have to wait for either Klaus's book in a few years or his woman friend, Andrea Reynolds, is writing a book about that aspect of their life together.
How has the case affected your public profile? People are used to you taking on unpopular causes and unpopular clients, but his was so much more, as we've discussed, like a soap opera case and just, you know, a really celebrity-oriented kind of case after a while because of the amount of money he had and because there were sex and drugs involved.
It has affected it in that way. People are used to me, as you say, taking high-profile cases, but usually on behalf of very poor people and people who I couldn't possibly profit from. Klaus is really one of my first high-profile, very wealthy clients, and I had a little uncomfortableness about that. I said to him when he first asked me to represent him, I said, you know, your fee is going to go toward representing several blacks on death row, battered women, Anatoly Sharansky in the Soviet Union, in defense of abortion clinics, and other cases that I do without fees. And if you're not comfortable with that, you ought to let me know. And he said he was perfectly comfortable with that. In fact, he said he would give the proceeds of his book to a legal defense fund because he realizes better than anybody else, had he been the butler and had the butler been charged with this attempted murder, he never would have been able to win the case. He couldn't have won the appeal and he wouldn't have won the second trial because he wouldn't have had the money to do the kind of investigation that we did, to hire the students, to hire the doctors, to hire the forensic experts, to go and look at everything a second time. It's a tragedy in this country that justice takes money and our government has not taken enough responsibility. You know, we pay Ed Meese's legal fees when he's investigated at $250 or $270 bucks an hour, all of which his lawyers were entitled to because they did a great job. But Meese fights hard against having legal fees paid for poor people on death row.
Well, you advocate a defense that's really involved with investigation where
that's you have
right. people going out into the field, and that's the most expensive of all.
Because justice is expensive. Mm-hmm. It does cost money, and I think the courts have to go more. I'm happy to see lawyers paid less. But I want to see investigators paid more because I want to see the truth come out. And the truth doesn't come out from lawyers sitting in their offices. What do? We read law books and we make telephone calls. The truth comes out when you can hire the kinds of experts to really get under the rocks and find out what really happened. And that costs money.
You know how some people seem to be permanently changed by their brush with the wealthy?
Mm-hmm.
And they just never – they stay there afterwards.
Uh-huh.
You know, it seems to be just a passing period or just a case or something, and then they stay with that level of money and celebrity after that. Were you or are you afraid that that'll happen to you, that you'll be interested in the poor people whose cases you've taken on?
No, Klaus von Bülow and his kind of people have driven me back to the friendly and wonderful poor. My major case now involves two young men on death row in Arizona. I've had enough of this lifestyle. It never really attracted me or affected me. It's interesting how people could misunderstand. There was a review, I forget where it was. I think it's going to be in the New York Times, where Nora Ephron says that when I went to Klaus von Bülow's house, I was just in awe of his wealth, and I had this gaga view. Well, you've read the book. You understand that that was all tongue-in-cheek. I had no respect for that kind of museum quality of the house. But somehow Nora Ephron, who has her own good cynical sense, missed my cynicism and got the sense that I was loving all this. Well, I didn't like it at all. I don't appreciate that kind of lifestyle. I'm much more comfortable with people of fewer means. You know, this case made me certainly appreciate being born poor. I don't want to end up poor, but it's a good place to have come from.
And it has had no, it has no attraction. This kind of lifestyle of idle wealth has no attraction for me at all.
So finally, what are the lessons, so to speak, of the von Bülow case that you're going to want to pass on to your students?
Well, the investigation, the fact that you just have to win your case, not in the library and not necessarily in the courtroom, but out in the field. The fact that you should never accept as a given the possible guilt of a defendant, as long as there's a possibility that he's innocent. The appellate process really can work to vindicate the innocent as well as the guilty. Civil liberties can work to vindicate the innocent as well as the guilty. You don't win your cases mostly on technicalities. You win them if you can prove that the truth has been excluded from a trial. Those are the lessons.
My guest is lawyer Alan Dershowitz, and his new book, Reversal of Fortune, is about the Klaus von Bülow case. He headed up the appeal for von Bülow and won. I'd like to switch gears here and talk about another subject that you're very involved in now, and that is that you've been criticizing the Mies Commission on Pornography, which recently concluded and I think handed in their report. You testified to the commission.
I did, yeah.
On behalf of Penthouse.
Right. They were the ones who just got me the opportunity to testify, but I wasn't testifying for Penthouse as much as I was testifying against censorship.
What were the messages that you wanted to give to the Mies Commission?
Well, first of all, this Mies Commission is a phony. It's not a commission on pornography at all. It's a commission which uses the title pornography as a way of giving the moral majority a wedge into censoring lifestyles and reading styles that don't promote the kinds of, quote, family values that the moral majority is trying to promote. Although the commission uses the title pornography, very interestingly, not obscenity, which is the legal concept. Pornography has no meaning. It just means something you don't like. You know, in the Soviet Union, Zionism is called pornography. In other countries, communism is called pornography. Pornography is really a euphemism. It was also a wonderful way of uniting some elements of the extreme right with some radical feminists who also, and for understandable reasons, are against sexually degrading material, which they call pornography. So my fear is that the Mies Commission will use this as an opening wedge to get at constitutionally protected material which they disapprove of. For example, the first target of the Mies Commission was not the kind of XXX-rated stuff you can see in peep machines downtown, but Playboy and Penthouse magazines, which are not pornographic by legal standards, but which they succeeded in getting out of the 7-Eleven stores in many parts of the country by putting undue pressure on those stores, sending them a letter saying, if you don't take it out, you'll be put on a blacklist, a McCarthyite blacklist, to be published by the United States, listing as distributors of pornography any store that sells Playboy or Penthouse. That just isn't the American way. And that's why I'm opposed to the Mies Commission and what it stands for and its, quote, investigation. It didn't conduct an investigation. It had a budget smaller than this radio station for a couple of weeks of work. It didn't do any of its own investigation. It just took some studies done by others, quoted them out of context. The people who wrote the studies are furious, for the most part, at the conclusions reached by the Mies Commission and came to the conclusion that if you put a guy in front of a pornographic violent movie hour after hour after hour after hour and then ask him questions about his attitude toward women and rape, it will affect his attitude. Of course it will. Ideas do affect people's attitudes. The First Amendment acknowledges that. That's why speech is so important, because it affects people's attitudes, both positively and negatively.
When you were testifying before the Mies Commission, if I understand correctly, you told the members of the commission that they couldn't come up, that they wouldn't come up with a recommendation that would embarrass the president or the attorney general, and therefore you were questioning their credibility. And I wonder if you think that was a very good tactic to basically offer that challenge to them and tell them that that the whole thing was a sham, basically, is what you said to them.
Well, it worked. It worked because what happened is a minority of the commission have now thrown the same challenge to the minority and have said to them, look, are we really men and women of our word? We have found no evidence, for example, that adult erotica, put aside for a moment, violent pornography, put aside for a moment, sexist pornography, simple adult erotica, men and women in lovely lovemaking poses, there's no evidence that that's at all harmful. Let's have the courage to say that. and to say the law should be changed to expand the ambit of available erotica. You think that the Mies Commission would actually have a press conference with the Attorney General of the United States, arm in arm around each other, Mies saying, you know, I've been wrong all my life, erotica is really not harmful, I recommend that the statutes be changed and expanded. It'll never happen, and they know it. And I thought it was a good tactic to confront them with it.
What did they say to you then? Would you get any response directly?
I did. I got a response from one of the people in the Mies Commission after I made this point saying, we've learned our lesson too. We will never give you another opening or opportunity or ask you another question again, because I think they were embarrassed by the response. But, you know, you say this is two separate subjects, the Mies Commission and the Von Bülow case. They come together in one sense.
What's that?
Because there were two efforts to try to censor my book on the Von Bülow case. The family tried to censor the book the first time around, and they threatened all kind of lawsuits. And now the Rhode Island Bar is trying to censor the book. So censorship is rampant. The appetite of the censor knows no bounds. If feminist extremists get enacted statutes that give them or anybody else the power to ban sexist material, the next step will be to ban material that advocates a gay lifestyle, material that advocates abortion, birth control. There's no stop. Once the government has the power to ban something because it's offensive or dangerous, that power will be expanded in other directions. And it's not going to be Gloria Steinem who makes the decision what to ban. It will be Phyllis Schlafly. It will be the Reverend Falwell. It would be Ed Meese. It will be Warren Berger. It will be Ronald Reagan. So I am so disappointed with Gloria Steinem. You would think that a brilliant woman, runs an excellent magazine, has been through the issue of censorship, would not come out in favor of this kind of censorship. And she's turned the corner recently and has become a strong proponent of censorship. She denies that she's a strong proponent of censorship, but she supports the Dworkin-McKinnon approach, which is censorship pure and simple.
Do you find that a lot of people, as you were describing it, have just one area that they think is really offensive to them, and
sure.
that should be censored, but then on the other hand, they're not for censorship, and they think everything else should be open?
Oh, there was a wonderful poll a few years ago where Americans were asked, as we approach the 200th anniversary of our Bill of Rights and Constitution, it's worth remembering, were asked whether they favor censorship. No, everybody said no. Do you favor the First Amendment? Yes. Do you think the government should ban the following things? And then it gave a checklist. Everybody wanted to ban something. Recently, a radical feminist at Harvard sent a memo around saying that Harvard should no longer allow its library to keep back issues of Playboy magazine. And so I wrote a memo saying, what a wonderful suggestion. It will solve all of Harvard's financial problems. Just send the memo asking everybody on the faculty and every student to list the one genre of material to which they would object and find most offensive. And then we could put all the remaining books into a couple of storage closets and turn Widener Library at Harvard into squash courts, because nothing would be left, only Mary Poppins. And even recently in California, somebody tried to ban Mary Poppins because it reflects a colonialist mentality. Everybody wants to censor something. And if you give everybody their choice of censoring one thing, there's nothing left. Censorship means denying people the right to choose. It is. The thing that offends me most, and here I know I'm going to get into trouble with some of your listeners, is that I think censorship and the issue of choice and abortion are very similar. I don't necessarily support abortion. I support choice. I don't support pornography. I support choice. People should have the right to choose what they do with their bodies and what they do with their minds and their eyes. And those people who do support the right of choice in one area and not in another, and you find any lineup on that on both sides, I think really have to look at the consistency of their positions.
There is that feeling, though, well, look, I support free speech, but I don't want the Nazis marching.
I don't want the Nazis marching.
And we know none of us are going to agree on the Nazi ideology, so why support them as you did in the March on Skokie?
Well,
I mean you could have said, well, theoretically, I support them, but
I don't
want to get it. You know.
I don't theoretically support anything.
No, that's not what I mean.
I don't ever theoretically support something. If I support it,
right.
I support it.
Uh-huh.
I don't sit on my theories. If I support the right of somebody to do something, I'm going to get out there and support it with my heart and my soul and my pocketbook as well. I don't obviously subscribe to most principles that I support. I mean, I wouldn't myself support financially many of the causes which I support their right to speak. And I think you have to stand up for free speech, particularly today, where I think it's being curtailed substantially.
both by elements of the right and elements of the left. It's a dangerous pincer movement, and the moral majority, I think, is one of the most dangerous private forces because of their influence in government today in America, and I don't want to see them win. And in order to beat the moral majority, you have to tragically support the right of Nazis, of sexists, of racists. I am sure one of these days I'm going to get a call from the people who stand in front of abortion clinics and make the lives of women who need abortions miserable by standing there and urging them not to have abortions. And if it is simply a question of urging of free speech, I will tragically and uncomfortably and against my own strong feelings in favor of choice have to defend that. If it goes over the border from speech to harassment, certainly from speech to harassment to physical violence or danger, then I'm completely on the other side. But speech must be protected.
Do you feel like your motives are misunderstood a lot by the American public?
Oh, sure. Look, criminal defense lawyers and civil libertarians never win Nobel Prizes or commendations or medals. We are a necessary evil. Every time we do something like defend the rights of pornographers or free guilty defendants, we are paying an insurance premium. And whoever wants to pay an insurance premium? But you got to pay your insurance premiums to build up capital for the Bill of Rights. And that's what we need in case tyranny ever comes to our shores, whether in the form of Phyllis Schlafly or the Reverend Falwell or anybody else. We have to have built a base of civil liberties, and that base is expensive and difficult, and people misunderstand it. That's why I like to appear publicly to try to help to explain that point of view. That's why I condemn lawyers who sit in their offices and refuse to speak to the public and make believe that the law is a secret profession, and judges who refuse to speak out. Lawyers and judges have to speak out more and persuade the public that the Bill of Rights belongs to them.
You went to the Yale Law School and you graduated first in your class. You're the editor-in-chief of the Yale magazine. And it seems like that would have put you in a position to be hired by virtually anyone. Did you go through a period of wanting to just be a corporate lawyer, make some money, and not have to anguish too much over the kinds of issues you're talking about now?
No, I never really wanted to work for a corporate firm, but I did have an interesting experience. Interestingly enough, one of the reviewers in the New Republic condemns me no end for indicating in the blurb that I was first in my class and editor-in-chief of the Yale Law Journal. The reason I do that is to be able to tell this story, that with those credentials, I was turned down by 32 out of 32 Wall Street firms to whom I applied for a summer job. In 1961 and 62 in the United States of America, Jewish lawyers could not get jobs in Wall Street firms. And I think it's very important for people to remember that, because yesterday it was Jews. Before that or after that, it was women and blacks and Hispanics. Today, it may be gay Americans, Italian Americans, Americans with different lifestyles, and there still is plenty of discrimination. No, I always wanted to be a civil liberties lawyer. Frankly, I never cared that much about money. I always have thought that too many lawyers spend too much of their time representing the tiny proportion of people who need it the least. They spend too much of their time simply reallocating wealth among the upper classes and too little time on representing the very poor and the middle class. It would be as if all the emergency wards of the hospitals were left empty because all the doctors were performing cosmetic surgery. That's what the legal profession today is too much about.
Well, you've said that you have the luxury of being able to decide what cases you take independently of what they can pay you for it, because you're a full-time professor at Harvard University,
right,
and get, you know, a good salary from them. It's still not the salary that's going to make you rich.
Mm-hmm.
Does money ever come into play when you're deciding who to defend?
I have a rule that I take at least 50% of my cases at any given time without fee, and I keep that unvaryingly. But when it comes to taking a case for a fee, obviously I don't do charity. I mean, I wanted Klaus von Bülow to pay me what he should have paid me. But I don't let it affect my judgment as to whether or not I'm going to take a case. But if I take it, I want to be well paid for it. My students kid me. They say my fees are zero or outrageous. I don't have too many in-between fees. I don't think they're outrageous, but legal fees in general are outrageous today. They're much too high for most people to afford. I like to say of myself that if I ever get in trouble, I probably could not afford to hire myself as a lawyer or anybody else because the fees are just too high. We have to do something about that, but we have to mostly do something about getting legal assistance to the middle class, the working people, and the poor people in this country. They just don't have access to the legal profession.
Because of the amount of money it takes.
The amount of money it takes. And again, with the increasing importance of investigation, the problem is getting worse, not better.
I've read that you get about 100 calls a day from people who want you to represent them. Is that accurate?
Well, it's more like 100 a week. But with mail, letters, calls, it's very, very high. And we get an enormous amount of correspondence. And I sit usually on Friday with my students, and we sit around. Remember the old TV program, Mission Impossible? They would sit around and decide which missions to take. Well, we basically do that. And we decide which cases we're going to take. And we try to keep a balance between cases that are going to make important law in different areas. And I can only take a certain number of cases, obviously, with my teaching and other commitments. But that's part of the fun, deciding which cases to take.
Do you write back to the people who've written you and you can't take on their case?
We try to write to everybody. Of course, with so many people, some of the letters tend to be form letters, and you make some enemies when you don't write or you write a form letter. But if I spend time personally responding to every letter, I'd have no time to do anything else.
One last thing about the Von Bülow case. You wrote in your book that when you took on the case, you were getting calls from psychics and astrologers all offering their services. Is that pretty typical for a celebrity-type case?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, some of the calls ended up being leads, not the psychic calls, but some of the calls we got from people who sounded like they were yo-yos initially turned out to give us some important leads. So you have to have somebody at least monitoring the phone at all times, because you never know where the break's going to come from.
So you take everybody seriously for the first couple of minutes and then weed them out afterwards?
First couple of seconds. usually you can tell pretty early on in the discussion.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here. My guest has been lawyer Alan Dershowitz, and he's written a new book called Reversal of Fortune. It's about the Klaus von Bülow case, and he headed up the defense for Klaus von Bülow and won. And Reversal of Fortune has just been published by Random House. His previous book, The Best Defense, was a bestseller. And thank you again for being with us. He's based in Boston and is a professor at Harvard University. Well, it's 6 minutes to five. We'll be joining National Public Radio at five for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening later this week on Fresh Air. But first, why don't we check in with shadow traffic?
76 westbound, a 30-minute delay now, west of Montgomery through Belmont, also slow between Gladwin and the Conshohocken curve eastbound. Your delay begins at the Blue Road down into Conshohocken. 95 northbound jam between Penn's Landing and the Ben Franklin Bridge. An earlier accident just now cleared. The ramp from Front Street, by the way, to 95 northbound is still closed. The Whitman ramp to 95 northbound is open. Traveling south on Route 42 in New Jersey, slow driving from 130 down through Route 295. Also, some heavy traffic on Route 70 at the Ellisburg Circle, then again at Mile Crest. That's shadow traffic, and I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM, WHYY.
Well, let me tell you what's happening next week, this week, that is, later this week, on Fresh Air. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we're going to hear from Quentin Crisp, who has written about his life in England in the 30s and the 40s as a gay man. And he not only came out, but he came out quite flamboyantly. He wore makeup, dyed his hair, and really called attention to himself, became very theatrical, in defiance of people's negative stereotypes about gays. So we'll hear from him at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. This Friday on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll hear from New Yorker film critic Pauline Kael, and then at 4 o'clock we'll be joined by Robert Parker, who writes the Spencer detective novels, and those novels are the jumping-off point for the television series Spencer for Hire. Well, Parker has a new Spencer novel that's just been published. This Sunday at 6 on The Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be songwriter Ellie Greenwich, and we'll talk about her hit songs that she wrote for the girl groups, including Be My Baby, Chapel of Love, and Leader of the Pack. So I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. Joyce Lieberman and Ron Barron were the engineers for today's show. Thanks to our interns, Abby Klebanoff and Tom Cellini. Amy Salad is the associate producer of Fresh Air. Danny Miller and I, the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a very good evening. This afternoon's Shadow Traffic Report was funded by Photomat. You're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, and we're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered coming up from National Public Radio. It's 5 o'clock.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Lynn Neary.
This is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
It's true we did not win, but I'm not embarrassed by what we did, and one can be proud of things.